This is East End Inc. Today we present Frances Levy and Patricia McCormick talking about the Kafka Studies Department, Levy's book of stories inspired by Kafka's work. The program was introduced by Marianne Calendrill of Canio's Books.
We're here to celebrate the Kafka Studies Department, a collection of satiric stories by Frances Levy of East Hampton, illustrations by Hallie Cohen, who is here with us.
Okay.
Wonderful. Welcome. Good to have you. And in conversation with Patty McCormick, Patricia McCormick of Sac Harbor, also known to you as a writer of great honors and achievements. Patricia McCormick is a two-time National Book Award finalist. She's author of several novels, including Never Fall Down and Sold. She's co-author of I Am Malala, among other projects that and publications that we've had here at Canio's. But we're featuring Frances Levy, East Hampton writer, writes for the East Hampton Star, has published previous comic novels, including 7 Days in Rio and Tombstone, Not a Western. And of this new book, the Kirkus Review describes it as a collection of bleak and amusing literary stories inspired by Kafka, a dark, sometimes funny meditation on the absurd trials of life. The collection is published by Heliotrope Books, and we are in for an engaging discussion. There'll be maybe some time for questions afterwards. We're always interested in learning about the writer's craft and process. So we're happy to have you all here, but please now give a warm welcome to Frances Levy and Patricia McCormick.
I'd like to say a few words on the subject of Kafka in our everyday life. After that, I'll read a short section from my book, The Kafka Studies Department. You may know Kafka from the short story, The Metamorphosis, in which Gregor Samsa wakes to find himself turned into a cockroach. Or perhaps by way of Joseph K., the enigmatic anti-hero of the trial, a now iconic symbol of the cosmic indifference of the universe. Philip Roth loved Kafka, and his novella The Breast does to the mammary gland what The Metamorphosis did for an insect, turning its leading character, David Kepesh, into a 155-pound breast. Perhaps you know Kafka through the word Kafkaesque, which has taken on a life of its own as a synonym for bureaucracy and impersonality. If Kay alludes to the author, what better way to dehumanize the individual than to take away his full name, turning it simply into a letter? The collaboration between Max Brod and Kafka is one of the greatest in the history of literature, to the extent that the author's friend spared a great writer's works from extinction. Luckily, Brod elected not to follow the writer's wishes, which would have reduced Kafka's legacy to only two works, In the Penal Colony and The Metamorphosis, which had already been published. However, Brod was committed to creating a certain image of Kafka that aligned with what would be a classic, if somewhat limited, interpretation of his work. Brod was, in effect, packaging his old friend as an existential hero. Ross Benjamin's new, fully annotated and unabridged edition of Kafka's diaries, which I believe I saw in here at one point, reveals a totally different personality. Apparently, Kafka laughed while he read his work to his friends. He liked women and also exhibited a distinct interest in Jewish culture and, in particular, the Yiddish theater. However, the question of Kafka's Judaism is Kafkaesque and laden with paradox. The very concept of belonging was inimical to him, yet his lover, Dora Diamond, in whose arms he died, said that his last wish was for Aliyah, which is to return to the Promised Land, Israel. In an article on the diaries for The New Yorker, Becca Rothfeld called Kafka an incompletionist. He never finished any of the 3 novels he started, with the castle ending mid-sentence. Rothfeld goes on to say, defendants in the trial spent hours mired in Talmudic debates about the conduct of court officials, all without coming to any consensus about what it signifies. Walter Benjamin called Kafka's writings fairy tales for dialecticians. You might look at them as dead ends whose import lies in their denial of answers or opportunities, or perhaps like a metaphysical diving board, offering at its end a leap of faith. A Hunger Artist is one of Kafka's most famous stories. One almost takes the title for granted. It's two nouns in apposition or opposition. Let's stop for a second and think about the juxtaposition of these two words and the conceit of professional fasting they suggest. Ernest Powell's biography of Kafka is aptly called The Nightmare of Reason. My friend, Arthur Frank, who's sitting right here, Columbia 58, wrote a paper for Mark Van Doren, who some of you may, the name of whom you may remember, entitled Mysticism of the Castle. He got an A-, but I firmly believe he deserved an A+. I've been working on that. Or at least an A for his effort. Here is the opening paragraph, which I think says a lot about Kafka's spirituality. Thomas Mann said that he would not care to dub Kafka a mystic. In the sense that Mann refers to an obsession for death or a search for an ultimate answer in death, Kafka was not a mystic, says Arthur. I was, however, able to extract from the almost overpowering allegory of the castle a sense of mysticism quite different from that alluded to by Mann. It wasn't the mysticism of death, but rather the finding of a unifying principle of life. My book, The Kafka Studies Department, is a series of parables or emotional mysteries written in a Kafkaesque style. I would now like to read the title story of the collection, The Kafka Studies Department. All the faculty of the Kafka Studies Department were withdrawn, retiring individuals who had had troubled relationships with their fathers and hence authority all their lives. When you met these rail thin, bespeckled creatures, most of whom lived alone in the kind of off-campus housing usually reserved for graduate students, there was little question how they had found their master. But while the whole is sometimes greater than the sum of its parts, the mere fact of a department devoted to the study of Franz Kafka, the only of its one of its kind in the country, had attracted international attention. The Kafka Studies Department was perpetually at odds with the university. Someone had to raise money, someone had to deal with an administration more interested in enrollment than excellence, someone had to handle the real world. None of these gentlemen had the least ability to cope with life. So when the letter arrived announcing a severe cutback in funding, no solution was proposed. Yet it was a blow at a time when the department's fine reputation should have put it in an exalted position. But no one dared speak up. No one knew how. Further, it was Kafkaesque. The administration was simply an illustration of the irrational malevolence of the trial. They would watch the department deteriorate. Life was imitating art. There were two students who stood out in the class that entered the year the Kafka Studies Department suffered the cutbacks that threatened its very existence. Martin was your typical Kafka scholar, painfully shy with a receding posture that made him look hunchbacked. His mocking sense of humor barely veiled his estrangement from life. Alfred was his total opposite. The Kafka Studies Department had never had a student like Alfred. He was a magnetic personality who parlayed his BA in Germanic studies into a Fulbright and then a series of business ventures that made him a wealthy man, at least by the standards of the Kafka Studies Department. While most of the students and faculty were celibate, Alfred had a beautiful Valkyrie of a wife whom he dressed in exhibitionistically sexy outfits. He made no secret of the fact that he wished his wife to look like one of the prostitutes who hung out at night on the edge of campus and whose services he solicited on his way home from the rare book library. Before Martin could even prove himself, Alfred was helping his professors develop a proposal for the National Endowment for the Humanities. He had also fomented a love affair between a beautiful Dostoevsky scholar he'd taken to the track and his mentor, an emaciated-looking 5'5" Czech whose PhD was an analysis of Kafka's Hunger Artist. Totally ignored in his attempts to get even a modicum of attention, Martin began to founder. When it was time to meet with his advisor, he'd pick up on the distractedness of the man and garble his words. His only paper of the year was an attempt to link the expressionistic painting of Edvard Munch to Kafka, it had been a self-fulfilling failure. Munch and Kafka had little in common. Everyone knew it. It was Munch and Strindberg. Yet he couldn't stop himself. The negative attention, the humiliation, was more satisfying than a conformity which would have condemned him to live in the shadow of his lusty colleague, whose very life, a series of manipulations, seductions and chicanery was an affront to everything Kafka stood for. Then one day, midway in the 3-year course, Alfred died. It was that simple. 1 week he had appeared in class pale and disheveled. The next month he was no more. Apparently Alfred, cocky and confident of his power over life, had ignored the warning signs of the fast-spreading cancer that would ultimately kill him. The German word Schadenfreude, which often appears in the Freudian canon, means the enjoyment of other people's suffering. Such was the hatred Martin had felt in the final weeks, as life seeped out of Halford. He allowed himself to thrive as he never had before. It was as if the blood were flowing out of Alfred into Martin. The more the once cherubic wheeler-dealer was diminished by his illness, the stronger, more decisive, and more physically imposing Martin became. He learned to stand straight. In Alfred's final days, Martin even met a woman with whom he embarked on his first affair. It was as if a huge weight were removed from his shoulders. By the time Alfred died, Martin's fortunes were already on the rise in the department. Within 6 months, Alfred had been all but forgotten, and driven by an almost mystical energy, Martin had been transformed. Where Alfred employed a crude cunning, Martin's energies were characterized by a sense of equanimity and a cultivation that far outdid his predecessor. Martin was really putting the Kafka Studies department on the map, and he was winning the attention he had never been able to get before. The professor who had flunked him on the Munk paper even admitted he might have been hasty. Perhaps there was a connection, he said. But Martin, having no more need for such futile stretches of the scholarly imagination, politely declined the invitation for a review. No, sir. He was interested in power. The way you got it was to play the right hand. Martin was on his way. During this time, he began a romance with Alfred's widow that eventually led to marriage. One of the items that they came across when they were cleaning out Alfred's closet, so Martin could move into the wonderful house Alfred had built, were the very loafers Martin had spotted through the crack in his advisor's office door. Just as his lovely new wife was about to toss them into a plastic garbage bag, he cried, "Stop!" He took off the cheap hush puppies of the impoverished scholar and tried on one of his deceased rival's cordovans. It fit perfectly. That same day, Martin sat facing his advisor. He laughed to himself, one of the loafers dangling lazily off his foot, as the shadow of the insecure first-year graduate student he had once been approached the half-open office door.
This is East End, Inc. We heard Francis Levy talking about the Kafka Studies Department, Levy's book of stories inspired by Kafka's work. Next, Levy was joined by writer Patricia McCormick discussing the book.
These stories are little gems, and I think that the short story format is really hard. I think it's harder than a novel. So I'm curious for you, and I know that you have a daily writing practice where you publish your work every day.
The blog every day. Yeah.
And so I want to talk to you, I want to hear from you about why that's a form that you like so much, and how do you know when you're finished?
That's a great question, because I don't partake of the classical short story. In fact, I sometimes have played around ironically with short story forms and allude to other short stories that are well known, like The Hunger Gun. One of the stories in here is called The Sprinter, and it's based upon the younger artist. But as I've said on other occasions, and I've told you, I don't think about these things in advance. In other words, the object every day is to overcome the writer's block. That's the basic, that's the whole purpose of my life. So I'm basically trying to get to the page before my ideation stops me, mm-hmm. and before I try to encapsulate mm-hmm. things. So, for instance, my first novel, Erotomania, I started to write about Erotomania. I didn't know I was writing a novel. In fact, over the years, the whole meaning of the novel and what it really was started to become apparent to me. But I actually didn't think of it. Like, in other words, I never think, people say, "Oh, Frank, that's you." But I never think about that. I never attempt to write autobiographically. Mm-hmm. But I'm not answering your question.
It's okay. Well, I think there's a real wisdom in being unconscious about that self in the story.
Right.
But go on.
But I think that I think the two things. I think that one is the attempt to get ahead of the, conquer the resistance to writing. Which one factor, there was a, I don't know if some of you ever read something called The Artist's Way, which is, and the whole purpose of the book is to stop the critical superego from coming in and stopping you from doing, putting words on the page or asking you. So in a way, it's antithetical to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I read every issue of The New Yorker, and I actually made all attempts to study, like George Saunders, mm-hmm. I really love many of the writers, and I think they're fantastic, So they influence me, but I never really think of trying to, work. I certainly not a O. Henry or de Maupassant form, although some people have accused me of being O. Henry-ish in these stories.
They've accused you of worse.
So, a lot of it is what you're saying. It's kind of works unconsciously, and the fact that it works a little like therapy, because every day I do it, I never miss a day. If we're away somewhere, I do it at the same time, same station, give or take, something or other. But it's always the same. And I'm always writing three different prose pieces a day and one other piece. So I'm always working on it. And Graham Greene used to write I'm not comparing myself, but he used to write like about 300 something words a day, every day. And it was always that. And I write on these pieces approximately that's what I write, 300 and something, 250 to 300 words. And actually, if the piece starts to seem like it has potentiality, I actually don't let it go. I stop because I want to have something to write about the next day.
Hmm.
I'm not letting you talk.
Go for it.
No, these things are not only related to my placing myself in a chair and a table, but they're also related to existentially where I am. In other words, these stories are very, very old. Hallie and I have been working collaboratively on this. She's my collaborator to the extent that, I show her pages of my work, and she says, "You must be joking." And they end up on the floor. This is true. It's not an exaggeration. this was actually a large book at one point. And then we did the whole thing, but we'll maybe talk about that a little later. We did the whole thing about working together, but that she's played in really invaluable. But the whole existential matter of where you are, when I say that the book, when I said that it dawns on me what the book is about, this book in particular is really, as I read it over after years, is infused with deeply personal things. But I wasn't thinking about that at the time. I wasn't thinking, I wasn't relating it to, mm-hmm. to things. In fact, the very first story, I was not thinking about it really, I confess, but it really had to do with being in Yale Drama School and a friend of mine who was very much like the character in the story.
Mm. You're not saying which one.
No, Rocco Landisman. He was, so we actually did and he didn't mention it once in our talk we had. Uh-huh. But the whole thing is, I started to write this on the second floor of there was a deli on 87th and 3rd, and I rented a small space from Phyllis Herfield, who's a painter, and I worked there, and all these ingredients of being in these particular places, have a strong impact. You want to interrupt? For instance, I started another novel in a writing workshop I did. It's actually done. It's a graphic novel called The Wormhole Society. The novel is not about the writing workshop, but I used a tenement building. I used the fifth floor apartment. I used the Mexican restaurant, which this is about parallel universes. So the Mexican restaurant became a portal to alternate universes. And then there was the McDonald's up the street. All these things are part of it. But then the deeper stuff comes in, because deeply speaking, I've said to Hallie many times, without her and my existence, this book couldn't ever, it's very apparent to me that it could never be, mm-hmm. This book is particularly infused with things that we talk about, mm-hmm. A lot, ideas that we talk about, things that we talk about. Mm-hmm. But if I was to sit down and say, well, I want to write, say, about my sister, it would be very difficult for me to do that. I have to make a charade up in order to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that leads to a question that I'd like to ask about absurdity. So many of the stories are about reversals of fortune or transformation, but it's always tinged with the absurd. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what you think the role of that kind of absurdity, that kind of humor, plays in these times.
Well, it's very interesting. I think it's a great question, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of this is about the notion of aspirationalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I can't equate it to the horrendous things that are going on in the greater world as a whole. But there's a lot of wishing that's going on,
mm-hmm,
in the characters, mm-hmm, and a desire to have something which doesn't exist,
mm-hmm,
inevitably wins over that which exists. In other words,
mm-hmm,
a character will be in love, he'll have a mistress, but the mistress is not really someone who's part of his life.
Right.
So she wins.
Mm-hmm.
She wins over the wife,
mm-hmm,
you know, and that's one of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a constant reversal between that functioning, between reality and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
That constitutes one element of it. But then there's a kind of thing like, which I really enjoy playing, sort of trying to be unscrupulous. One of the stories is called The Book of Solitude. So this guy writes a book about, you know, devoted to people who live in a solitary existence.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually devoted to this solitary existence. Except the problem is it becomes a bestseller. So there are people lined up all around his house. You know, that's I think that's one of the most absurd stories you know, and that's the kind of thing that happens again and again. And the other part of it, and I think I don't know if it constitutes the kind of absurdity you're talking about, but there's one character who he gets everything he wants, and then he finds himself perched in this moment that it's, that there's nothing there. There isn't anything. This has all been, he's been sold a bill of goods,
mm-hmm,
basically. You know, another character wakes up, he's been sleeping, and in the dream, in the sleep world he's been in an enormous success. He's had all these things happen to him. He doesn't even know how he's going to deal with it all. But then he wakes up,
mm-hmm,
you know, and he's in his room and his wife's left,
mm-hmm,
you know. And then, so there's this constant desire to have enormous things, grandiose fantasies,
mm-hmm,
and I think that fuels what you're talking about a little bit,
mm-hmm,
you know, because they're so out of kilter,
yeah,
mm-hmm,
with the nature of existence itself,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so the longing is so grand, and sometimes it's about belonging. These are these lonely characters who are seeking some kind of connection and belonging and
right,
attention that's really elusive
right,
to them. And then when they get it, it's a disaster. And when they don't get it, it's a disaster.
Right.
I want to go back to what you said about a charade, though, that you would use a charade as a kind of way to approach a subject rather than hitting it head on. Can you talk about that a little bit
more? Yeah, I mean, this is interesting because, I mean, my impression of you is that you really, you do some really incredibly difficult things, and there's no charade.
Yeah, I'm a head-on kind of gal.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And so, especially your moth, you know, that wonderful moth incident that you related. So, yeah, I mean, I think the methodology is one in which I'm trying to get over my defenses,
mm-hmm,
you know, about the material.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I constantly concentrate on just the words and sentences that are in front of me, and this sounds very manipulative, but the iterations like become, like I sort of say to myself, oh, that's a great, it's not really fair what I'm writing. I often say that to myself, this is really unfair, but it sounds good. You know, mm-hmm, and I say, and if the turns of phrase are coming, and sometimes, in fact, my friend Rocco once said to me, I find myself laughing. I'm laughing, you know, I find, because I like to play with humor, so I'm laughing. And he said, do you realize that other people may not find this funny? But I mean, you know, that's the thing. I'm so, I'm it's actually entertaining to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these kind of people, and then I know that this is self-fulfilling prophecy, but I'm not one of these kind of, you know, like writers who are like, I can't say that the actual act of writing is a form of torture for me. I actually find the actual act of writing increasingly interesting because I can have things a little bit more the way I like them.
Mm. You're king.
Right. Yeah. I'm king and I can do them. And I find that the cell phone has liberated me because now I write on my cell phone. I write emails to myself.
you know, so that I, in other words, I'm writing something, but I'm, you know, but mm-hmm. What you're talking about is key, because always there's always the sense in which, you know, disinhibition is the name of the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're suffering, I mean, the inhibition is what is the, it's what the killer, it's the killer of everybody's, you know, whatever they're doing. Because a lot of people say to me that, what should they do? And I really have to say this, that I think that when people sometimes come to me, like last week I met a really great guy. And he's a science fiction writer, so he started to tell me his whole story, the idea. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to stop him because I'd been, that's going to kill him.
Yeah.
That's killing the kind of extemporaneous relationship to the page and the writing and the words.
Right.
You know.
It dilutes the experience.
Right, right. Yeah. But there's a kind of, I have to have a certain equanimity about this thing because, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm really depending a lot on my inner psychology to develop a moral universe, and I... I have a highly developed superego, so like I am, you know, I may not like what I'm writing. I may not like what's coming out, and that poses problems sometimes.
We heard Frances Levy and Patricia McCormick talking about the Kafka Studies Department. Levy's book of stories inspired by Kafka's work. They were recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. The Kafka Studies Department was published by Heliotrope Books in 2023. Other books by Frances Levy include 7 Days in Rio from $2 Radio, published in 2011. Works by Patricia McCormick for children include I Am Malala with Malala Yousafzai and Never Fall Down, set in Cambodia. Some upcoming readings at Canio's Books include on Saturday, February the 3rd at 5:30 p.m. Poems for World Peace. Invited guest readers share a poem that speaks to the world's yearning for peace. On Saturday, February the 10th at 4:30 p.m., Professor of Religious Studies Tom Petriano leads a discussion of Alexandra Hudson's The Soul of Civility. Details at canio'sbooks.com. On Thursday, February 15th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., the annual African-American Literature Read-In, co-sponsored with John Germain Library. Readers are welcome to present a short selection from your favorite work by an African-American author. Today's East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Zoka of Canio's Books. Help keep East End Inc. on the air. Go to wpkn.org and click on the donate button. This is Hazel Kahn.